most phones today, unless you have like an ancient phone, or you don't have one, of course that's a different story, there's a slow motion feature on your camera. You can take video in slow motion. Has anyone ever done that? Have you ever used that feature? I can't say that I have ever used it either. But there are some things that might be actually very useful to film in slow motion. For instance, if you were watching a bird, I've seen wonderful documentaries on hummingbirds. You know, their wings beat so fast, they're just a blur. But if they really slow down, you can actually see their wings move, right? It's really phenomenal to watch. In fact, I love watching birds in slow motion, whether they're diving in to get fish out of the water or whether they're doing their mating rituals or something like that. It's wonderful to watch birds in slow motion. So perhaps if I saw a hummingbird come up to a feeder, I might, if I had enough awareness, pull up my phone and try to film the bird in slow motion. Sometimes we see slow motion used in sport. If there's a contentious call on the field, they'll show it to you many times from many angles, usually in slow motion, so you can decide for yourself what the call should be. Sometimes you'll see slow motion used in a film at a critical moment when something's happening, and it slows it down to make the dramatic effect more powerful. I've also seen that used in comedy as a kind of parody of that as well, to make it more funny. One of the features of the four Gospels is that the storyline overall tends to move quickly along as Jesus goes about his ministry in Galilee and then in Judea, but when we get to Palm Sunday and then we walk through Holy Week, and Holy Week is the time between Palm Sunday morning and Saturday, that's called Holy Week, When we get to Holy Week, the story starts to slow down. In fact, it starts to begin to move in slow motion. In the Gospel of Mark, the first year or two of Jesus' life, of his ministry, is taken up by two-thirds of the Gospel, but that last week is taken up by about a third of the Gospel. In the Gospel of John, it's almost a half of the whole Gospel is found in that last week. That last week is taken up by half the Gospel of John. And so when the story starts to slow down at a point in the Gospels, it's usually there to draw attention to what's happening in that moment. And that's what we see in the Gospels during Holy Week. That's why that prayer ministry that Sally was leading through Holy Week is so wonderful, because the story moves so slow that you can't get there when you go from Palm Sunday to Easter, or Good Friday to Easter. There's just so much crammed in there, and it's really hard to guide people through that last week that takes up a third or a half of the Gospels, but we kind of just jump over in 1 week. As we get closer and closer to the cross, the story starts to slow down further and further until it moves into that slow motion. As I say, the Gospel writers are drawing our attention to something that's happening in Jesus' life that's very important. Step by step, they show us what happens. See, because we're at a critical juncture in what Jesus is up to. And this slow motion continues into the resurrection stories. Today we start one of the most famous resurrection stories in the Gospels, a journey to Emmaus, which involves Jesus coming alongside two of his disciples as they journey back home to their town of Emmaus. And so we're going to spend the next 4 weeks slowly going through this story, because this journey to Emmaus is 23 verses long. It's a long story, and it's told in slow motion. And we have a tendency to want to race through this story as we go through the Easter season. We spend one Sunday on it, and then we move on to other gospel stories connected to the resurrection, and we have to gloss over so many of its important features, especially the interaction between Jesus and the disciples. So as I say, we're going to take four Sundays to go over the story to Emmaus. And the reason that this journey to Emmaus is 23 verses long is because we're meant to notice all the details. That interaction between three people as they journey from Jerusalem to the small village or town of Emmaus. And the story of the journey to Emmaus begins with these words, that very day. What day are we talking about, do you suppose? That very day. Anyone want to guess? What's the day that the story of Emmaus is talking about? Well, it's Easter, right? We're still on Sunday. We're still on Easter Sunday. We've already moved on personally. We're a week from Easter. We're already moved on. That was last Sunday. That was long ago. That was a week ago. It's already a blur in the rearview mirror, but Luke is still writing about Easter Day. As they say, we're in a slow motion mode here. The story is unfolding slowly. What has happened on Easter so far in the Gospel of Luke? Well, let me remind you that the women led by Mary Magdalene have gone to the tomb to anoint Jesus' body for burial. But when they get there, they notice the big stone over the tomb has been rolled back. And that freaks them out. And then they look into the tomb and they don't see Jesus' body there. And they're struggling to make sense of all this when all of a sudden these two celestial visitors come to them and they begin a conversation with these women. And they say to Mary Magdalene and her group, they say this, and I got this on a slide, Dave. Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise? As you can imagine, this really overthrows the women in the moment. And they immediately go back to the apostles. And they share with the apostles what they've experienced, what they've seen. And the apostles simply dismiss the story as outlandish. They just dismiss it out of hand. Interestingly, though, right in verse 12, 11 and 12, it says that Peter ran to the tomb and found it as it was described by the women, with the linen clothes for the body still there in the tomb. And Luke reports that Peter went home marveling at what had happened. See, a lot's already happened on Easter morning before we get to the story of the journey to Emmaus. The day's not even over yet. We might not have even gotten to lunchtime yet. And with all this happening, with what happened on Thursday evening in the Last Supper, and then Jesus' arrest, and then his trial, and then his crucifixion, and now these reports of an empty tomb, and angelic epiphanies to these women, and Peter confirming the discovery of this empty tomb, we hear in the story to Emmaus that these two disciples are going back home. They're going home to Emmaus. And we'll find out next week that one of the disciples' names is Cleopas. Although his companion is never named in the story. We're not really sure why. Many people think that it's actually Cleopas' wife, but she's not mentioned in the story. Just an unnamed companion that walking with Cleopas. Do you find it kind of strange, though, that these two disciples of Jesus are leaving at this moment? My impression is, as they say, it's not even lunchtime yet, and they're heading home. Even though the women have come back from the tomb with this incredible story, it was dismissed as an idle tale. But then Peter goes to the tomb and he confirms what the women have already reported, at least in some detail. The body's not there. The Jesus body is gone. And personally, I'm surprised that Cleopas and his companion are leaving at this juncture. Why would someone leave at this critical juncture in the Jesus story? As I say, it seems odd to me, but then, of course, we only know in retrospect that this is a critical juncture in the Jesus story. It's obvious to us who know the end story, but for Cleopas and his companion, it's not obvious at all. If it had been obvious to them, they would have stayed. It says in the passage that we read today that Cleopas and his companion were discussing all the events that had transpired. Probably all the way back to Thursday evening, all the way through Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning. They're talking about all this that's happened from Jesus' arrest onwards, including his trial and execution. And now these reports of angels and empty tombs. And even though Cleopas and his companion have left the scene, so to speak, they're still caught up in the moment of what's unfolding. And I don't think the English translation quite gets the intensity of the conversation. They are wrestling with something very important as they walk along. They have this very intense conversation between the two of them as they go along back home to Emmaus. And as Cleopas and his companion are wrestling in their conversation, a stranger approaches them and begins to walk with them. And Luke tells us that it's Jesus who draws beside them. He tells us, though, that the two companions, Cleopas and the other, do not recognize him. In fact, Luke says that these two companions were kept from recognizing him. And I'm thinking there's a connection between Cleopas and his companion leaving Jerusalem in the first place, and they're being kept from recognizing Jesus as he comes and walks beside them. Now, I want to show you a short clip, video clip. The main speaker is N.T. Wright. Most of you probably don't know New Testament scholarship, but N.T. Wright is one of the most important New Testament historians and theologians today. We call him a biblical theologian. And he wrote one of the most important books on the resurrection of Jesus. And there's a lovely little interview conversation that lasts about 4 minutes that I want you to watch. So let's just take a look at that.
That's right. Well, you mentioned a few moments ago that there is something surprising and very bold at the heart of Christianity, the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. Say more about that. suppose somebody says, look, give me a break. That doesn't happen. I gather at one recent debate on this, someone brought in a nurse who had said, listen, you've been in hospitals, you've seen people die. Have they ever come back? and so on. And so how do you respond to the initial skepticism that someone may have of, how could that possibly be?
Well, the first thing to say is that people in the first century knew just as well as we do that dead people don't come back. If you read from Homer through Socrates to Plato to Pliny, whenever they mention the possibility of resurrection, they say, come on, as you say, give me a break. We know that doesn't. And the early Christians knew that just as well as we do. This is, again, part of this chronological snobbery thing. And this is a C.S. Lewis line about that. He says, you know, people often imagine that the ancients didn't know the laws of nature and that we now that we have modern science, we do. And he said, apropos the virgin birth, the reason that Joseph was worried about Mary's pregnancy was not because he didn't know where babies came from, but because he did. And the same with the resurrection. The disciples were not going around saying, oh, well, isn't that interesting? So people sometimes come back from the dead, you know. No, this was not one instance of what now appeared to be a new possible general rule or something. Far from it. Rather, this is a place where people often get confused. Because people say, oh, well, the Jews believed in resurrection, so when Jesus died, they naturally thought he'd come back. Well, no, most Jews of the time did believe in resurrection, but resurrection, they believed, was something that God would do for all his people at the end of time. Nobody ever imagined it would happen for one person in the middle. And you can test this because we know 100 years either side of Jesus, we know of several Jewish resistance movements, messianic movements, rebel movements. Routinely, they ended with the death of the founder. And we have in the histories of Josephus and so on, accounts of what happened next. If the man you followed, who you believe is the king, the new leader, the one God has sent, etc., if he gets killed, you have a choice. Either you give up the movement or you get yourself another leader. And we've got evidence of movements that do one or other of those things. In no case do we have people going around saying, actually, I think he's been raised from the dead. Because, you know, they were more hard-headed than that. They, you know, life is real. We've got to get on with it. And in particular, the idea of choosing another leader, the leader of the church in Jerusalem throughout the next generation, James, who was Jesus' own brother. Now, it's very interesting because he was a great leader, a great teacher, a wonderful man of prayer, etc. But nobody ever said that James was the Messiah. If Jesus' body had stayed in the tomb, that would have been the natural thing. Well, it wasn't Jesus, too bad, but here's his brother. He's a great teacher. We revere him. And he was the man who was physically closest to this Jesus who sadly got crucified. So that would have exalted James, but they didn't. They called James the brother of Jesus, the brother of the Messiah. And so as a historian, I am forced to say, when I look at the rise of early Christianity and why it took the shape it did, there are all sorts of things which make me say, I cannot actually explain how Christianity got going as a renewal movement in Judaism in the first century, and why it took this specific shape, unless they really all did believe that Jesus was really bodily raised from the dead. And when you say, but why would they believe that? Could this have been a corporate hallucination or whatever? You can look at those arguments, and I've looked at them and I've written about them, and actually that doesn't work either. They knew about hallucinations. They knew about ghosts. They knew about odd, wacky experiences. There's plenty of literature about that in the ancient world, and they weren't so stupid as just to go wafting off on some idea like that. This was a very definite thing. He really has been raised from the dead, and that was why they did and said what they did.
Why did Cleopas and his companion leave Jerusalem? And N.T. Wright says, when your Messiah dies, you have two choices. You leave the movement, or you find yourself a new Messiah. As I say, you go home, or you get someone new. As N.T. Wright says, we have examples of people doing one or the other when their Messiah dies. And that's exactly what Cleopas and his companion are doing. They're going home. Why are they going home? Because their Messiah is dead. When your Messiah, your king, your leader dies, that's what you do. You go home. As N.T. Wright says, people in the ancient world were quite informed about the laws of nature. He mentioned something called chronological snobbery. You know, that ancient people before us, maybe even only a generation or two before us, are a bunch of rubes. They don't understand. They don't have the sophistication or knowledge to understand the way we do today. I saw a perfect example of this on a video of a debate between a New Testament scholar and an atheist philosopher on the resurrection of Jesus. And the philosopher dismissed the ancient world in one glass as a bunch of naive, susceptible, and ill-informed people. And yet ancient people understood how the world works in some ways better than we do. You know, as a practical matter, I think meat just magically shows up in the supermarket. Do you actually think very often about where it comes from? You know, I'm totally divorced from the world of butchery and meat packing plants and such. I just think it magically shows up. I mean, ancient people understood where meat came from. They understood the significance of blood and the sacrifice of an animal for the nourishment of human beings. And they understood that dead people stay dead. Once something's dead, it's dead. It ain't coming back. There was no confusion in the ancient world about this. And Cleopas and his companion are not confused about this either. That's why they're going home. It's over. There's nothing that's happened on Easter morning that changes that. That's why when the women came to the apostles and told them what they'd seen and heard, it was dismissed as an idle tale. Because, see, everyone knows that dead people stay dead. And I think it's Cleopas's preconceived ideas about what is possible and what is impossible that precludes him and his companion from seeing Jesus when he joins on the journey with them to Emmaus. There's definitely some force interfering with their ability to see him. The Greek literally says that their eyes were ruled, possessed, so that they did not know or recognize him. The question is, what was interfering with their perception, such that they didn't realize it was the Lord walking beside them? And the verb is passive, right? So we don't know the agent. If I say, you hit the ball, we know who hit the ball. It was you. But if I say the ball was hit, that's the passive form, we don't know who the agent is. Who was it hit by? Their eyes were seized by something, but we don't know what it was. Was it God that was interfering with their perception? Perhaps. Was it the devil? I doubt it. was that their preconceived notions of what they thought was possible or impossible that determined what they saw or didn't see. See, because they didn't see Jesus within them. And I think it's personally my preference is for the latter. They didn't see him because they already knew he was dead and he couldn't be on the road to Emmaus with them if he was dead. And even though his body was missing, it didn't change the underlying facts of the moment that he was still dead. A disappeared dead body is still a dead body, whether it's in a tomb or not. See, if a crucifixion does anything very well, it kills a person. Kills the person very well. Nobody comes back from death, but nobody especially would come back from a crucifixion. Crucifixion was the ultimate way of killing somebody because it didn't just kill them, it destroyed their body. So the two disciples are going to their hometown of Emmaus, and they don't recognize Jesus when he comes beside them because they know better. See, their basic beliefs and assumptions about reality tell them that he can't be there with them. And I'm thinking to myself, do you think there's something interfering with your belief or my belief in the resurrection of Jesus? Is there something interfering with or blocking us from recognizing his presence in our life? Is there something interfering in this moment for all of us that stops us from seeing him here? Or maybe in a more general sense, is there something blocking you perceiving the presence and purposes of God in your life? See, it seems to me a lot of people today, modern people, treat all the witnesses in the New Testament to the resurrection of Jesus with great skepticism. There's a lot of chronological snobbery today in our culture. The same kind of skepticism that those apostles brought to the women when they came with their report of what they'd seen and heard, that kind of skepticism, that dismissal of their experience as folly or idle talk or nonsense, that kind of skepticism is what we carry forward to all the commentary often in the New Testament about Jesus' resurrection. And I wonder, like, do we think today that what Luke writes in this last chapter, chapter 24, in the gospel is folly and idle talk and nonsense? See, because I think a lot of people today do that. Even in the church, I think there's great skepticism to what the witness of the scripture says to us. And people write off the earliest church witness because it doesn't conform to their pre-existing views today of how life works and how it doesn't work. We'll bring a nurse in and convince ourselves that dead people don't come back to life. N.T. Wright, in his book on the resurrection of Jesus, spends a great deal of time reviewing all the Greek and Jewish literature around resurrection. And what he shows in his book, and it's like 800 pages long, is that there is no analogy for the resurrection of Jesus in the ancient world. It doesn't exist. There's no analogy. We know there's no analogy to the resurrection of Jesus Christ in the modern world either. It's a one-time event. In fact, what the earliest church proclaims is a completely novel message. And by novel, I mean fresh, new, peculiar, offbeat, unique. What we hear in the scriptures in the Gospel of Luke, for instance, is a completely new, fresh, peculiar, offbeat claim given to us. That Jesus is alive, raised from the dead. In a real, tangible way, he's alive. It's not a hallucination or a vision or some ghost or another fantastical kind of event. He's alive. And just remember what N.T. Wright says as a historian. He says he can't explain why Christianity rose in the form that it did unless at its core, the message that Jesus rose from the dead in a tangible and recognizable way is true. Without that, there's no explanation for the rise of early Christianity. If it's not true, there can be no church, historically speaking. Without Jesus rising, there would be no first church. Without Jesus rising from the dead, there is no Trillium. We wouldn't exist as a community. The earliest church witnessed and believed in Jesus' resurrection. That's undeniable. That's undeniable. And they invite us to receive their witness and trust and believe in what they tell us today. And we can walk like the two disciples to Emmaus. And we can be blind and dumb to who walks beside us in life. Or we can open our hearts and eyes and invite God to come in and show us what really is true.